Day minus 8, 1930. Ready? Kelly says to Jem when she arrives home. He's standing in their kitchen, trainers and a parka on, a smile on his face. He doesn't notice her misty eyes. For parents' evening? He says, a question in his voice. Henry VIII is winding his way around Kelly's feet. Parents' evening. Perhaps it's this. Perhaps this is why she skipped back more than one day. Like Andy said, this must be an opportunity of some kind or other. She remembers dreading this, but tonight she feels ignited by it. Bring it on. Let me notice the thing. Let me figure this out and let it end. Sure, she says brightly. Yeah, forgot. I wish, he says. Let's just not go. Kelly hates these sorts of things too, though for different reasons. His relating to the establishment. The last time she took a selfie of them in the car, wanting to put it on Facebook, and he stopped her. He holds the door open for her now. How was the office? Jen looks down at her jeans and T-shirt. Yeah, had a meeting with an old client, second divorce, she says, glibly as they leave, as though she does much repeat business. Kelly doesn't seem to mind enough to ask. The school hall is set up with tables spaced so evenly it looks like something from the military. At each one sits a teacher, two empty plastic chairs in front of them. Jen thinks of Todd at home alone playing Xbox, unknowingly waiting for his arrest for possession of a knife he might not even have. The first time she lived this evening, all of the reports were glowing to her relief. Mr. Adams, the physics teacher, described Todd as a joy. Jen had been distracted by work, she remembers, considering what to do about Gina's divorce and how to convince her to allow her soon-to-be ex access to their children. But that single word had pierced through the membrane of busyness, and she grinned as Kelly said dryly, "Just like his parents." Jen is sitting here opposite the same man now. The hall is brightly lit, the floors shining. Jen and Kelly sent Todd here to a good comprehensive. They didn't want Todd to go to private school, to become part of the institution. They settled on this, Burley Secondary School, a place full of well-meaning teachers but with terrible dated classrooms and grotesque bathrooms. Sometimes, today in particular, Jen wishes they'd chosen somewhere else, some place where a parents' evening would provide Nespresso coffees and comfy chairs. But as Kelly had once said, he'll get decked later in life if he spends his formative years in a choir singing hymns with a load of knobs. Yes, sharp, engaged, Mr. Adams is saying. Jen's attention is firmly on him. He's an avuncular sort of man. Big ears, white hair, a kind face. He has a cold, smells distinctively sweet, the scent of Olbers oil on a handkerchief. She missed this last time. It doesn't matter, but she still missed it. Along with what else? Anything we should know about? Mr. Adams looks up in surprise. Like what? Is he, you know, hanging out with anybody new, working less hard, doing anything out of character? Perhaps lacking common sense at times in the lab. Kelly laughs softly under his breath, the first noise he's made since they arrived here, her introverted husband. He reaches for Jen's hand, fiddling with her wedding ring. After this session with Mr. Adams, he will go to the table serving tea and coffee, get them two teas, but drop one. The absurdity of this knowledge. Oh, but the brightest minds are, Mr. Adams says. Honestly, he's a joy. Jen's heart is full of sunbeams for the second time. You can never hear enough that your children are good, especially not now. They scrape their chairs back and walk over to the trestle table along the back. Jen debates taking the tea from Kelly before he drops it. She watches his hands. These things are so fucking pointless, he says to her under his breath as he faffs with tea bags. So dystopian, like being in some sort of crazy evaluation system. I know, Jen says, passing him the milk. Judgment ahoy. Kelly smiles a pained sort of smile at her. How long until we can leave? How long until we can leave? Soon, she promises him. Do you think he is a good kid, she asks. Honestly. Huh? Do you think we're out of the woods? You know, teenagers going astray.
No,
not Todd going astray, a voice says at Jen's shoulder. She turns around and there's Pauline in a bright purple dress and a cloud of perfume. Who knows, Jen says with a sigh. She'd forgotten this interaction, totally forgotten that they met here. Kelly wanders off in the direction of the bathroom. Pauline raises her eyebrows. Wonder if your husband hates me, she says. He always disappears. He hates everyone. Pauline laughs. How's Todd then? I don't know, Jen says to Pauline. I think we're heading towards some rebellion. Connor's teacher just said he's not handing in any homework, Pauline says. None, Jen says, thinking, is this relevant? This small piece of information, so small Pauline obviously forgets to relay it in a few days' time when Jen asks. Who knows, teenage boys, laws unto themselves, Pauline says. Theo's the only one with an unblemished record. Right, geography calls, prayers appreciated. Jen touches her shoulder as she leaves. Kelly comes back, resumes making the tea. As he passes it to Jen, it falls straight onto the floor, an eruption of beige liquid, tea bag and all. Jen stares at it, bubbling away there. They see Mr. Sampson next, Todd's form tutor. He looks barely older than Todd, side-parted dark hair, a kind of eager-to-please expression. All good, he says quickly, crisply, while Jen sips the tea. She thinks suddenly, horribly, of what Mr. Sampson will say in the future, the day after the crime, the day after that, day plus one, day plus two, each one an equal and opposite reaction to day minus one, day minus two. Good kid, never knew he'd have it in him, he will say sadly. Jen can just see it now. Must have been unhappy in some way. You've not noticed anything, Jen asks Mr. Sampson now. Perhaps he is ever so slightly more withdrawn. Is he? He's not involved in anything, is he? She asks. Anything, I don't know. I sometimes wonder if he's gone off the rails a bit. Kelly turns to her in surprise, but Jen isn't focusing on him. Mr. Sampson is hesitating, just a little. No, he says, but it contains an invisible ellipsis that streams out into the air after he's finished speaking. He sips a coffee. He winces as he swallows. No, he says again, more firmly this time, but he doesn't meet Jen's eyes. Ryan. It's Ryan's fifth day at work, Friday, and 5 minutes ago, everything changed. He arrived at the station, and this man, this Leo, told him he wasn't working on response today. He walked Ryan into the large meeting room at the back of the station, more of a boardroom, and Ryan had watched curiously as he locked the door behind them. Leo is maybe in his late 40s, slim but jowly, his hairline receding. He speaks with a jaded kind of brevity as though he's never not talking to idiots. Similar to Bradford, but not at Ryan's expense. Not yet, anyway. Unlike Bradford, whose reputation Ryan now knows to be that of an embittered junior, Leo's generally regarded as a crazy genius. Much worse in many ways, but much more interesting too. They have just been joined by Jamie, who is maybe 30. These men are not only in plain clothes, but in actual scruffs. Jamie is in jogging bottoms, a stained T-shirt and a black baseball cap. Leo looks like he is about to go and coach a football team. Ryan is feeling fairly uneasy at this point, sitting opposite these men, a giant table between them. Sorry, what is this? He starts to ask. We'll get on to that. He has a Cockney accent, a signet ring, on the little finger of his left hand which clinks against the wooden table. Where did you say you're from, Ryan? Manchester, Ryan says, wondering if he's about to get sacked. Can I just ask? Next to him, Jamie takes his baseball cap off and rubs at his hair. He puts the cap on the table, very deliberately, it seems to Ryan, over the recording equipment. Ryan's eyes track to it. 999 response is pretty boring, isn't it? Leo asks. For sure. Look, how do you fancy doing something more interesting? We can call it research. Research? We need information about an organised crime gang operating around Liverpool. Day minus nine. 1500. That it is day minus nine makes sense to Jen. She has come to the school. She's here the day before parents' evening to see if she can get any insight into what was underneath Mr. Sampson's hesitation last night in private. People are always more confessional in private. He has mentioned a falling out, I seem to remember, he is saying to Jen. Mr. Sampson teaches geography. Behind him there is a wall that seems to be a tribute to the features of the world he likes the most, the white desert in Egypt, a cave of crystals in Mexico. He is leaning back against his desk, facing Jen. When and with who? Jen says. She looks around this classroom which must greet Todd every morning, but that she has never seen herself, never had time to, because of her job. Green speckled carpets, white desks that seat two students, blue plastic chairs. She found out her mother died when she was in the classroom just like this, called out by the head teacher. She hadn't returned for several days afterwards. Her father had hardly talked about it. Can't change what's happened, he'd said once. Repressed, unhappy at times, a very typical lawyer. Jen had been so determined to parent differently, openly, honestly, humanely, but maybe she'd fucked it up as much as he had. Isn't that what Larkin says? Her phone rings in her handbag on the chair. Mr. Sampson's eyes stray to it. Jen checks it. Just work, she says, declining the call. It instantly rings again. Do answer, he says with a wave of his hand. Jen picks up reluctantly. This is not what she is here to do. I've got someone here for you, Jen's secretary Shaz says. Mr. Sampson busies himself at his desk. I'll be in late, Jen says. It's Gina. What shall I tell her? Jen blinks. Gina, the client who doesn't want her husband to have access to their children. Some memory is coming to Jen, some small detail of Gina's life. She stalls, trying to think. That's it. The last time Jen saw Gina, she turned to Jen on the threshold of her office and said, I should have seen it coming. It's literally what I do for a living. Personal investigator for my sins. Jen had nodded slowly in recognition. It cannot be a coincidence that Jen has woken up on this day, the day Gina is in her office. Maybe this isn't about seeing Mr. Sampson at all. I'll come in, she says. Tell her to wait. She hangs up and turns back to Mr. Sampson. Sorry, sorry, she says hurriedly. When was this falling out? A week ago, maybe? He said he'd had a domestic, that's all. With who? He didn't say. He was talking to someone. I just overheard. Who was he talking to? Connor. The same names. The same names keep coming up over and over. Connor, Ezra, Cleo, Joseph himself. He also said something about a baby. What? I'm not sure. It just came to me. Something about a baby. Right, it would have been good to know before now, Jen says, one of the very first times she has said exactly what she thinks to somebody like this, to somebody outside her immediate family or colleagues. How liberating it feels. Next, she will be telling clients to go fuck themselves. Right, Mr. Sampson says awkwardly. She stares out of the window. It's foggy out, but still mild. Summer still feels just within reach. She watches as the shallow mist moves like a tide back and forth over the playing fields. She gives a friendly but helpless shrug, saying nothing, the kind of stony silence Kelly would impart. It is so therapeutic, not having to deal with the consequences of her actions. This meeting is contextless, like a dream, like a conversation with a drunk person who will not remember. I'll check in with him tomorrow, Mr. Sampson says, and Jen hopes maybe that'll help somewhere in the future. The mist becomes mizzle, becomes rain, as Jen heads to her car. She looks absent-mindedly for Todd's and spots it immediately. As she watches, Connor arrives too. He's late. She stands there with one hand on her car door, looking, hoping to see something. But nothing happens. He locks his car and smokes a cigarette on his way into the building. His tattoo is hidden today, under a round-neck jumper. At the door, he turns to Jen, raises a hand in greeting. Jen waves back, but she's surprised. She didn't know he'd seen her. The police badge, the missing baby poster, and the phone were not on Todd's wardrobe when Jen went home just now. She searched and searched for them, but they were gone. She assumed at first that he has not yet acquired them, but the texts on the phone date back to the 15th of October. Nevertheless, they're nowhere to be found, and so she has nothing to show Gina, who she is now well over an hour late to see. Gina is sitting in the chair in the corner of Jen's office wearing a beige trench coat and a muted expression. I'm so sorry, Jen says. I'm having a family drama. She puts down her umbrella, leaving damp droplets on the carpet. That's fine, don't worry, Gina says cordially. Jen had been wary of crossing the boundary from professional to friend with clients, but she has, in these past few weeks, with Gina. They've even texted a bit. It doesn't matter. Jen is the business owner after all, but Jen now wonders if all of that happened for a reason. She tries to remember what she said in this meeting the last time. Can I just ask, she says, removing her coat and powering up her computer, trying to step back into Jen, the professional advisor, what your plan is if you succeed in preventing your ex-husband's access to the children? He'd come back to me, wouldn't he, Gina says, so he could see the kids. Jen bites her lip. But, Gina, it doesn't work like that. Gina looks around Jen's office with panicked eyes. I know, I'm being mad. She drops her head. You've helped me to see that. Jen feels choked up, despite herself. God, she relates to this now. This desperation, this denial, this urge to exert some kind of crazy control somehow. That's what I'm here for, Jen says thickly. But you know, it's better to move on, isn't it? Forwards. God, I'm getting all anxious again, Gina says, wafting her hands at her eyes. The reason I'm doing this for free, Jen says gently, is really because I don't plan on doing it. Right, Gina says. She crosses and uncrosses her legs in the chair. She has on wrinkled clothes. I know, I realised when we were, she wipes her eyes, when we were talking about fucking Love Island, I thought those girls would never beg. How sad is that, taking lessons from a bloody TV show? It's very informative, Jen says dryly. Gina looks down at her lap. I just need a bit of time, okay? Okay, good, Jen says. Good. This has gone better than it did the last time. Fancy distracting me with your family drama, Gina says wanly. Maybe, Jen says with her own wobbly smile. She glances at Gina as she straightens up in the chair. Hit me, Gina says. Jen hesitates. This is both unethical and perhaps dangerous, and yet so useful. Here she is on this day, at this meeting, surely, surely for a reason. She's already decided to ask Gina about the poster, the badge, and the texts on the burner phone. Baby or no baby? What does that mean? She isn't supposed to know Gina's occupation. She hasn't been told yet, but she breezes past that, and Gina doesn't seem to notice. Jen explains how Todd has been behaving strangely, and then she found the bundle containing the police badge and the poster. And you don't have them with you now? Gina asks. Her eyes, alert now, are on Jen. No, sorry. My son had them, but he doesn't anymore. Jen licks her lips. I'm pretty sure he's mixed up in something dark. I need someone to find out what. Gina meets her eyes and blinks just once. Her mobile phone starts ringing, but she ignores it. All right, me. Yes. So, to be clear, you want me to find out what I can about the police officer Ryan and the missing baby, and Nicola Williams. Exactly, Jen says, marvelling at Gina's upright body language. How different we are at work to how we feel inside. Leave it with me, she says, and Jen could kiss her. Finally, some help. Gina meets Jen's eye. And thank you for, you know, for Love Island. No problem, Jen says, her eyes damp. You need the info ASAP. Ideally today, Jen says. Is that okay? I'll pay whatever you need to get it by this evening. Gina waves a hand. What is it you say? Pro bono? Right, Jen says. Yes, pro bono, for the public good. After all, isn't that what stopping a murder is? Jen stays in the office using the various tools at her disposal to pillage information. She emails the firm's librarian, asking her to find details of any babies who've gone missing in Liverpool recently. She sends back a few articles: court battles, people who've lied about their children being kidnapped, a woman whose baby was snatched outside a supermarket, then returned to a doctor's surgery. Jen makes her way methodically through them. None look like the missing baby. There is something base about her recognition of it, something familiar. It must be a maternal instinct. She looks up Nicola Williams next, but the name is so common and she has nothing else to go on. She should have taken down the number, memorised it. Nicola. Nicola Williams. Wait. That first night, in the police station. Was Nicola Williams the name she heard in the police station the night of Todd's arrest? The name of the person who'd been stabbed two nights previously? Jen sinks her head into her hands at her desk. Was it? She feels sure it was, but she can't go forward, only back. And it's no use Googling it. It hasn't happened yet. Say it was Nicola who was injured. The thought chills Jen. Where was Todd? What did he do on day minus two? Is he connected to that? She can't remember. It's all a blur. She doesn't know. She just doesn't know. Jen leaves the office and drives aimlessly. The rain has intensified. She doesn't want to go home, doesn't want to go back to the scene of the crime, doesn't want to sit in the house, failing to work everything out. She drives slowly towards the coast. She knows it's mad to go to the beach in the rain, but then Jen feels mad. She wants to stand there and feel it, each cold drop of water on her skin. She wants to remind herself that she is still here, still alive, just not in the way she's accustomed to. She parks up at Crosby Beach. It's deserted. Rain snakes down the path, leading to the sea in stripes, already a few inches deep. Jen's hair is slicked to her scalp within seconds. It smells of cold brine. The wind whips the grit of the sand into her face. She walks past a homeless man sitting by a car parking meter. He's soaked through, and Jen feels so guilty she passes him a wet £5 note. The beach has the Anthony Gormley exhibition on it, another place. Dozens of bronze statues looking out to sea. Jen approaches them, the noise of the downpour around her as loud as a train. She is the only human on the beach. Her feet sink into the pale sand that compacts like snow. She stands by one of the metal figures, shoulder to shoulder, and looks at the blurred and rainy horizon, spending time with the statue instead of another person. If only she could work this through with somebody, she'd figure it out much more easily, she's sure, if she wasn't always alone. The statue's body is freezing cold against her palm, its mouth wordless. Together they look at every single metal figurine, each in a different time, in a different place, alone, looking out to sea for answers. That evening, late, Jen heads out back to Ishi Road North, just hoping to observe something. Bad criminal things only happen at night, so she may as well sit and watch the house. She still hasn't heard from Gina. At 10:15, Ezra leaves the house and gets into his car, wearing a uniform of some sort. Dark green trousers, green jacket, high-vis waistcoat. Jen follows him, keeping well back, her headlights on. Just a normal driver, just a coincidence. They drive like this for a while down a track road and crossing a staggered junction. She follows him all the way to Birkenhead Port. He gets out and takes a clipboard from another man there, looping an ID around his neck with one hand and fumbling for a cigarette with the other. He He takes up a position to check cars in and stands there doing nothing except smoking. Jen's shoulders sink in disappointment, so he only works here. She leaves the engine idling, watching as a Tesla appears. The port is blustery, leaves tossed on the breeze. It's busy too, cars coming and going, but the Tesla does something different. It flashes its lights, then disappears slowly down a side street. Ezra follows it on foot. She puts the car into gear and is just behind them. She parks randomly on a drive, hoping to look like a resident, and switches her lights off. A boy, only Todd's age but shorter and blonde, gets out of the Tesla with an oblong-shaped package under his arm. Ezra greets him, shaking his hand, and together they crouch in front of the Tesla. It takes Jen a few minutes to work out what they're doing. They are removing the plates from the Tesla and putting different ones on. The kid leaves and Ezra drives the Tesla back through the car parking barrier and leaves it waiting to be loaded onto a ship. So Ezra is a bent port worker then, taking stolen cars, plating them, and shipping them somewhere else to sell, no doubt for cash given to him on the side. She supposes the blonde boy is a foot soldier of sorts, paid a pittance to steal the cars from people's driveways, with the promise of gang advancement ahead. What if Todd is working for Ezra and Joseph too? It goes wrong somehow, and Joseph ends up dead. Jen doesn't want to believe it, but that doesn't mean it isn't true. She waits a minute before leaving. She passes the boy, walking by the side of the road. She looks carefully at him. His gaze is fixed ahead. He can't be more than 16, a teenager, a baby, burning bright, with no idea of the damage he is doing to his mother, waiting at a window back home. It's almost midnight, and Gina has sent across photos of 12 babies who have gone missing in England in the past year, none from anywhere near Merseyside, and none that looks exactly like the baby in the poster. Some have lighter hair, some larger eyes, though it's hard to know for sure that they're different. Jen is suddenly struck by the terrifying thought that the baby may not yet be missing. She scrolls up through Gina's texts. She missed them all while she was distracted at the port. Nothing on Nicola, name too common. I have something on Ryan, though. He's dead. Panic flashes across Jen's body as if she has been doused in hot oil. She calls Gina immediately, but there's no answer. She rings again and again and again, but Gina doesn't pick up today. It's gone. They'll have to start from scratch tomorrow, 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 yesterday. Day minus 12, 0800. 12 days back, and Jen opens her eyes on the exact day Nicola Williams texted Todd's burner phone saying, "It's in place, but see you tonight." Jen is therefore determined to follow Todd today, not to let him out of her sight. Personal investigators be damned. This has got to be the better way. Jen can't start over again with Gina today. It's too disheartening to lose it all when she sleeps. She follows Todd to school and intends to wait outside all day in the car park, as long as it takes. She has absolutely nothing better to do. The only requirement of today is that Todd has zero opportunity to meet Nicola alone. She sends some work emails while she waits, eyes on Todd's car and on the school doors. She researches local missing babies and goes deeper into the probate registers looking for Ryan, but she uncovers nothing. It begins to rain around 11 o'clock, fat drops that land like falling pennies that disappear to nothing on her windscreen. She stares out as the car park becomes a moving, shivering river. She'd forgotten this. Mid-October had been unseasonably wet. Jen stares up at the rain striking the windscreen, thinking about the weather, her son, and the ripple effects that can spread from a single raindrop. She thinks about what the implications are for the changes she makes today. She wishes she understood it. Maybe she can. It'll just take a tedious explanation first. She dials Andy's office and is surprised when he answers straight away. You won't know me, she starts hesitatingly. No, clearly not, he says, deadpan. She explains her predicament as briefly as she can while he communicates a baffled and judgmental silence down the phone to her. And that's about it, she finishes. A beat. Okay, he says. I do get these calls from time to time, so I can't say I'm surprised. No, pranksters usually, right? Jen says. She's seen them about too. She read another thread on Reddit this morning from somebody claiming to have time-travelled to 2022 from 2031. She didn't believe it, despite experiencing much the same thing herself. This guy couldn't even prove it. Says there's a nuclear war in 2031, and nobody can disprove that anyway. Yeah, exactly. Hard to know who to believe, isn't it? He says. She can't bear it. She can't bear for anyone, even this virtual stranger, to think her mad or needy or a malingerer, someone who calls up professors and bullshits them. Yeah, look, later on in October, you're shortlisted for and win an award, she says, the Penny Jameson. This won't help me much today, but, well, there you are. You win. That award is embargoed, I know. I don't know I'm shortlisted, but I do know I'm in for it, but you shouldn't. Yes, Jen says, it's all I've got, my proof. I like your proof, he says succinctly. I'm happy to accept it. The clarity of scientists. I've just Googled that award. It isn't anywhere online. That's what you say the next time. Another beat of silence while Andy seems to consider things. Where? Do we meet? His tone is noticeably warmer. In a cafe in Liverpool city centre. I suggest it. You wear a t-shirt that says Franny and Zooey on it. My J.D. Salinger, he says in surprise. Tell me, are you outside my office window? No, Jen says with a laugh. This must be infuriating, then, to have to go through these, security questions with me each time. Yes, it is, Jen says, honestly. How can I help? When we meet in Liverpool in a week's time, you talk about the power of my subconscious landing me on certain days. Yes, Andy says, and Jen is struck there in her rainy little car that it isn't his expertise that matter, only somebody sympathetic, actively listening on the end of the line, some safe space to hold her thoughts up to the light. Isn't that what everybody needs anyway? Gina? Todd, even? Well, that is definitely happening. I'm skipping multiple days now, and I think the ones I end up on are significant in some way. Well, good, I'm glad you're working it out within the framework available to you, he says. She hears bristling, a hand across a beard. So you have more questions? Yes, I wanted to ask, let's say in a few days, a few weeks, I work this out. Yes. I just want to know, really, the extent to which the things I've already done will stick, so to speak. Like, I told Todd on one of the days that he kills someone in the future, but I'm now back before that conversation has taken place. So, has it? Andy pauses, which Jen is glad about. She needs somebody who considers things, somebody who doesn't speak to fill silences, to make wild guesses. Eventually, he speaks. It's the butterfly effect, isn't it? Let's say you win the lottery on day minus 10 and continue to go back through time to day minus 11, day minus 12, and so on. If at some point you solve the crime and wake up on day zero, are you still the lottery winner from day minus 10? Exactly, that's what I want to know. I don't think so. I don't think the things you're doing now will stick. I think you will go onwards from the day you solve it, and only changes from that day forward will remain. They will wipe the rest. That's just my feeling. Tap, tap, tap go the drops of rainwater. Jen watches them land and then spread, forming rivulets. She opens a window and extends her arm out, just feeling it. Real rain, the same rain she's experienced once before on her skin. And just say, if I don't solve it, I think it'll become clear. Have faith, Jen. There's an order to things that we sometimes don't even know. This man, this kind, smart man on the end of the phone, becomes a guru to Jen, a wise old professor, a Gandalf, a Dumbledore. But, like, what if I just cycle back 40 years to oblivion and then that's it, she asks. Now perhaps her greatest fear. She swallows as she thinks this horrible, catastrophic thought. Oh, to have a brain that does not torture itself. Well, that's all any of us is doing, only in the other direction, he says, which does nothing to ease Jen's anxiety whatsoever. Do you mind if I just tell you everything I know, just to see if you can spot anything, she asks him. Shoot. I even have a pad and paper, and I am soon to be crowned one of the great physics minds in Britain, if your premonition is correct. Oh, it is, she says. Okay, so, and she tells him. She tells him about the missing baby poster, the dead policeman, and about the burner phone, and the texts to Nicola Williams. She tells him about the port worker and how she suspects it's organized crime. She tells him about Nicola Williams maybe having been stabbed too. She tells him every date, every time she knows. As she speaks, she hears the sound of a pen being uncapped, probably a fountain pen, a distinctive hard click. And that's all, she says, breathless with having divulged everything. So, putting that into chronological order, he says. Okay, yes. Todd meets Cleo in August. Her uncle is running some sort of, I don't know, crime ring. Okay, so then, into October, she hears him leaf through papers. You say Todd appears to ask somebody called Nicola Williams for help, perhaps setting her up to meet and then she's harmed. Yes, and at this point, the 17th of October, the baby is likely already missing and the policeman is also probably dead, his ID taken. Jen sits back. What was a stormy ocean is now so clear she can see the bedrock beneath it. That's that. Well then, seems like Nicola is the missing piece. She's the one you know the least about, and a person who seems to be directly connected to Todd, and who was injured two nights before the crime. Okay, yes, I need to find Nicola, Jen agrees. At 3:30, Jen follows Todd home and arrives at the door 2 minutes after him. He turns to her, his face perhaps a little pale, but otherwise looking pretty cheerful, and says, "Did you know that a flea can accelerate faster than a rocket?" "I'm fine, thanks. Had a half day," she says sarcastically. "Well then, mother, look at this." He puts his bag down and begins rooting through it, a clear, sunny expression on his face. Not a sniff of organized crime, of gangs, of violence, dead policemen, of anything. "Look." He passes her an essay, grade A star, his fingers just brushing hers, as light as a feather. Jen stares down at it, a biology essay. She vaguely remembers this. Last time, in the evening, she had issued a perfunctory, "Well done." Todd's A stars are the rule and not the exception. This time she reads it properly. "It's amazing," she says after a few minutes. Todd blinks in surprise, and that blink, it cracks her heart open just a little. She's tried so hard, but look at his shock. "How long did it take you?" she asks. "Oh, you know, not long." "Well, I couldn't do it. I don't even know what photosynthesis is." "Yeah," a soft laugh. "It's plants, mother." His eyes are on his own essay, reading it back, a sketch of a smile across his features. He's so confident. She has done one thing right, at least. Hopefully Todd will never sit up at night and doubt his own parenting, his intellect, his self. "What are you going to do tonight to celebrate?" she asks. He looks at her. "Absolutely nothing." "You've no plans?" she asks again. Am I in a court of law? Todd says, holding his hands up. You're not seeing anyone? Cleo? Connor? Oh, curiosity beckons, does it? I wondered when you'd get nosy about Cleo. Consider that day today, Jen says weakly. Todd turns away from them, heading into the kitchen. Meh. Meh? Not sure it's a runner. What? She was your proper girlfriend? No longer. Todd's jaw is clenched as he says it, staring down at his phone. Kelly arrives in the kitchen. His gaze tracks Todd. He appears to be deep in thought, though he doesn't say as much. I have a job on, he says. He's pulling his coat on. Sure, Jen says, vaguely. What's happened with Cleo? It's off limits, Todd says tightly. Kelly clatters some cans in their cupboards, then swears. They are my cokes, Todd says to him. Well, later then, Kelly says. I'll get my own coke. Adieu, Todd says to Kelly, perhaps somewhat sharply. I think I'm going to celebrate my essay by melting my brain on the Xbox, he says to Jen. He grabs an orange from the fruit bowl and throws it to her with a laugh so loud it thrums in her heart like a bass drum. I love you, I love you, I love you, she thinks as she catches it. Is this photosynthesizing right now, she says, holding the orange up. Don't use words you don't know the meaning of, Todd says, coming over to ruffle her hair. Whatever it is you've done, Jen thinks, I'll never not love you. The entire evening he doesn't leave the house. Jen checks on him at midnight, and he's sleeping. She stays up till 4 just to make sure, then goes to bed herself. There is no way that today he has seen Nicola Williams. None at all. Ryan. The best part of Ryan's recreational training in Manchester was the hint of what was to come in this interesting long and varied career he had ahead of him. Hostage negotiation, terrorist prevention training, undercover work. There were so many ways to develop as a police officer. They'd had a talk from an officer who trained people under the reasonable force legislation, and he'd stood there at the very front of the lecture theatre. The officer said one of the most interesting sentences Ryan had ever heard in his life. Coppers, when it comes down to it, can be pretty neatly divided into two types. Those who can kill when they need to, and those who can't. The hairs on Ryan's arms had raised up. Which was he? Could he do it? Pull a trigger if the situation dictated it? And so today, thinking about that interesting lecture, it is doubly disappointing to be told by Jamie that not only is he being taken off response calls to do research, but also that there are no spare offices for him. They have set a desk up in the cleaner's cupboard for him. Will that be okay? Ryan is happy to work in a cupboard, yes. But doing what? He looks around it. It's freezing. No heating and it's cold outside. Grey linoleum floor. Rows of shelving, a desk moved in temporarily with a letter rack on it. A corkboard and a mop bucket lean against the wall. That's it. To be fair, they did remove the rest of the cleaning stuff. Leo arrives in the cupboard looking harassed. God, how small is this room? He says. None of the cells free? He carelessly grabs a sheet of paper sitting in the letter rack. It's lined, and he turns it over to the plain side. All right, shut that door, he says to Jamie, who steps away from it. Finally, Ryan is going to get an explanation. So, he begins to say, this is what we know, Leo talks over him in that way that he does. There are two different organised crime operations trading in this area, right? They overlap, but, roughly speaking, one is nicking cars and one is importing drugs. The money from both is then funnelled. He dots a ballpoint pen on the paper, then draws an arrow upwards. We have the names from surveillance of three suppliers who we haven't yet arrested, but we're looking for the importers, one rung above them. Ryan nods eagerly. Yep, I understand all that. Right, anyway, next, Leo continues. The gang consists of two arms, drugs and thefts. The drugs come in, but the same port workers turn a blind eye to what goes out, which is the other arm, stolen cars. Other men, we think. He draws a box away from the arrows, the pen dragging across the paper. Are stealing cars. They take them overnight, get them to the port, then they're gone, before the owners are even awake, to the Middle East. They then launder the money. The two ops never cross. Obviously, Ryan says. Is it obvious? My brother. Oh, yeah, the brother, Leo says. Tell us more about the brother. He sits forward, his eyes shining strangely. I did disclose him to HR and vetting, Ryan says, panicking. Leo makes an impatient gesture. I know, I waved it through, I'm not suspicious. It's helpful to us, your brother. Who better to work out the who's who of a gang than someone who's witnessed how these people operate? I see, Ryan says slowly. So, would his ops be separate too? Yes, always, like you'd never use a stolen car to import drugs. You'd get nicked immediately. Right, Leo says. Right. Can you tell us more about him? He was quite a lot older than you, right? But same dad. Question after question after question. Don't mind Leo, Jamie says dryly. He has a one-track mind when he gets going. Answers, please, Leo says. Yes, Ryan says. Okay, well, a fair bit older than me, yes. He got mixed up in some stuff. I don't know, we were quite angry, I guess. We both always have had this ambition, but his became a bit misguided. He needed money and he started dealing drugs. What drugs? Just so we can talk, you know, skill sets. Well, he just progressed in a totally cliched way. Puff, then coke, then gear. Did he bring the gear home? Leo watches Ryan intently. Sometimes. Did you see it? I mean, yeah, Ryan says, blinking. If we had some gear now, how would you open it? Like a cracker, Ryan says, without even having to think about it. Exactly, Leo exclaims. He thumps the table. Leo frightens Ryan. He might indeed be one of those crazy genius types, or he might just be mad. I helped him a lot. It invades your life, gear. Doesn't it? I was curious, in the end. Ryan gives a despairing laugh. I was fucking cutting it with him. Good. Good knowledge to have. Ryan says nothing, about as confused as he's ever been. Leo glances at Jamie, then speaks. We'll have a job for you after your research, Leo says. He picks his tea up and finishes it in three noisy gulps. He places it on the table. If you're interested. Very, Ryan says, looking directly at Leo. We need someone brainy. Know why? This gang has probably got a nerd in it, right? Someone who's working stuff out for them. Some sort of foot soldier. Okay. So we need our own nerd, Leo says, reaching over to touch Ryan lightly on the shoulder, to analyse that information. Not only that, we need a nerd who actually knows how this shit works. We know three of the dealers, but none of the car thieves. We need their names, faces, how they relate to each other. A big old family tree of crime. You up for that? He gestures to the corkboard. So your task is to watch every minute of that CCTV and see who brings the cars. Okay. Oh, right, yeah, Ryan says. He becomes aware of his heartbeat, a strong, clean, excited thudding in his chest. Then, when we know who they are and their movements, we'll catch them in the act. You know, as close to entrapment as we can while staying legal, he says easily. Even Ryan's arms and legs feel excited, as if he could get up and do star jumps. Finally, something that fucking matters, something that he might be good at, something where he could change the world. Leo grabs the corkboard and sets it on the desk. Ryan loves the drama of it, the cut and thrust of policing. Here he is, home. Leo pins the piece of paper on the board, and on it he writes a name. This bloke works at the port, and he's bent. Turns a blind eye and allows stolen cars on. We got him on the very corner of CCTV. Haven't nicked him yet, as we want to see what sort of cog he is in the machine. All right. Ryan looks at the paper pinned up there. Ezra Michaels. See who brings the cars to Ezra. Okay, Leo says. And then, Ryan says, looking up at Leo, hopefully, once we know a bit more about them, I mean, he gestures to Leo's scruffy clothes, to Jamie's hat. I've got your department right, haven't I? Covert. Yeah, Leo says, simply. communicating something that, until now, has remained unsaid. Undercover. Day minus 13, 1900. A police car followed Todd home today, Jen is sure of it. She thinks of the car that drove past Cleo's twice. It's the evening now, and Todd and Kelly are sitting opposite each other. The lamp on the breakfast bar is on, the sky a lit-up pewter beyond the doors. The trees outside have more leaves on them. What just a few days ago was a thick collection on their patio is now a cluster of bright red flags back in their spots on the trees. Good evening, Squire, Todd addresses her. We're talking about Schrödinger's cat. Jen spent the morning at work pretending to be normal. She had an initial meeting with a new client who she knows tells her in a few meetings' time that she doesn't want to leave her husband after all. Jen took far fewer notes this time. Todd's eating a Chinese takeaway out of the box like an American, except it isn't in a kitsch carton with chopsticks in it, but a plastic Tupperware container, bless his heart. Kelly widens his eyes at Jen across the breakfast bar. We are not, he says with a laugh. You were. I was eating wings. I'm not sure Dad is your best audience, Jen says, and she hears the perfect little amused exhale that is her husband's laugh. What happened with the Venus and Mars project? Kelly asks. Todd inches his phone out of his pocket and passes it to Kelly. The first time Jen lived this day, she was at work, didn't know anything about this project. Kelly reads Todd's phone for a few seconds, then says, Ah, an A! A for astrophysics prodigy. A for Alexander Kazemsky, Todd says. Can you speak English? Jen asks. He is a great physicist, Todd says. This assignment. He passes her his phone. Well done, she says sincerely. She starts to read the assignment with interest, partly wondering if it might contain some science that might help her, but Todd takes the phone off her. Really, don't be worried about it. I'm interested. You never usually are, Todd shoots back. A guilty stone arrives in her stomach. Maternal guilt, that thing she has always tried to work against for much of her life, but that always, always sits there anyway. You never usually are. You all right? Kelly says with a laugh. You look like the Grim Reaper. Todd snorts into his takeaway while Jen dishes hers out. Kelly leaves the counter, his mobile ringing. She stares into the hallway thinking about Todd. What do you mean? She asks him. I mean, you don't usually pay attention to my stuff. Your stuff? Jen says, the world feeling suddenly still. Todd says nothing, reaching for a chicken ball and eating it whole. Do you think I don't listen to you? She asks. A kind of hazy awareness is descending on her, the way cloud cover does. You can't quite see it if you're in it, but you can feel it. Todd seems to actively consider the answer, looking down at his plate, his brow furrowed. Maybe, he says, eventually. He is still staring at her. Kelly's eyes, but everything else is hers. Dark, unruly hair, pale skin, unbearably large appetite. She made him, and look, he thinks she doesn't listen to him, just says it like it is a plain fact. It isn't interesting to you, he adds. Oh, she whispers. I care about physics, he says, so it isn't funny that I care about Alexander Kuzemski. I actually care about him. Jen experiences the eerie feeling of being wrong in an argument, so totally wrong. Her mind performs gymnastics. This isn't about planets, this is about their relationship. Todd with his fun science facts and his head in the clouds, Jen with her wry inability to understand what he is talking about. That's how she has always thought of them. She and Kelly couldn't believe they'd made such a cerebral child, clever in a totally different way to them, both so earthy and Todd so... not. But he isn't something made. He isn't an object. Here he is, right in front of her, telling her who he is. She's let her own insecurities about being stupid turn his intellectualism into something to be laughed off. Laughed at. God. She puts her head in her hands. All right, I see. I'm sorry. It's not... I'm so sorry, she finishes lamely. Okay, he says. Everything you do is interesting to me, she says, tears springing with the kind of reckless fatalism of somebody who won't be here tomorrow, a deathbed proclamation, a call from a hijacked plane, a woman who can connect and connect and connect with her son, but it doesn't matter, it won't last. I have never loved anybody as much as I love you. Never will, she says plainly, her eyes wet. I got it wrong. If I don't show you that, because it is so true, it is the truest thing. He blinks. His expression ripples into sadness, like a stone dropped into a pond. Thank you, he says. It's just, you know. I know, Jen says. I know. Thank you, he says again. You're welcome, she says softly, just as Kelly strides in. I ate all the balls because this last one's mine too, Todd says with a smile. The joke's a deflection, armour against their other family member witnessing this private moment, but Jen laughs anyway too, though she wants to cry. That was a client, Kelly says needlessly. Jen glances back at Todd. He puts the final chicken ball in his mouth and smiles up at her with his eyes. She reaches over to tousle his hair, which he leans into like a neglected animal. Todd drops the Tupperware right into the bin, something she would usually complain about but chooses not to today. Where to tonight? She asks him. Snooker. He does a chef's kiss in the air. Jen nods quickly. Well, have fun. Then she adds, I'm going out too. Drink with Pauline. Are you? Kelly says in surprise. Yeah, I did tell you. A lie. Which venue? She asks Todd, hoping to sound only curious. Crosby. She smiles at him, because the reality is, wherever he goes, she will be there too. The entrance to Crosby Sports Bar is an anonymous little black door on the high street, a retro neon sign above it, an England flag above that. It is a 20s building, with mullioned windows, red bricks, and three chimneys along the top. Jen pulls up in a car park at the back, shared by two restaurants, the sports bar and a travel lodge. As she gets out of her car, she smells char-grilled meat, pushed out into the autumn air by a vent somewhere. God, she's had a Chinese, but she could totally eat a burger. She tries the door at the back of the bar, even though it looks like a fire door. It's jammed shut, locked. She goes to the front, peering through the glass, hands either side of her head. It's dark inside. She can't see anything at all. She could just stay here, she thinks, the glass cooling her forehead. She's so tired. She's so fucking tired. Let her just stay here and cease to exist. Let her become part of the snooker club, an ornament, not a tortured, living, breathing human. A light flicks on inside, red-toned, dim, illuminating what is right in front of her, stairs painted black, shabby, stained, old, and more importantly, empty. She pushes open the door and ascends as quietly as she can. They lead to an empty landing, two closed doors either side of it, the perfect place to sit and listen, the perfect place to take a risk. She holds her breath. After a few seconds, she hears the click of the balls, the thump of the end of a cue onto the floor. A full-length Art Deco window sits behind her, letting in the glow of the streetlights. The floor is painted black, rickety old wooden floorboards that creak as she moves. Next week, for sure, Todd says. A click. He must have taken his shot. Jen leans over towards the hinge of the door and peers through, hoping nobody will see a single eye over here in the darkness. Maybe we can go away next summer, Cleo says. It's definitely Cleo, her dreamy voice. Todd moves back and forth in her vision. He holds his snooker cue like a staff, exactly the way a wizard in his favourite computer game holds it, his weight on it, his other hand on his hip. Jen's heart turns over in her chest as she gazes at him, her son. He is acting. She is sure of it. His hair is coiffed. his trainers bright white, pacing slowly around the snooker table, moving in and out of view. He is in full bravado mode. "If you're still together," a male voice says. Jen is pretty certain it's Joseph, though she can't see him. "Sure we will be," Todd says, nerves thrumming his voice. Jen can hear them, detectable only to her, like the shivering after a piano key is depressed. "Good shot," another voice says, perhaps Ezra. "Hope I'm not interrupting." This time, a female voice. Jen shifts, so she can see. A woman has entered from a dark door at the other side of the snooker room. She's about Jen's own age, maybe slightly older. She has greying hair scraped back into a tidy ponytail. Her outfit looks casual, jogging bottoms and a t-shirt. She walks in an alert sort of way, full of verve, like an athlete. "Nicola," Joseph says, "a nice surprise." "Nicola," Jen just about manages not to gasp. "Long time no see." "Indeed." Joseph walks into view, leaning on the queue. Nicola follows him. "This is Todd and Cleo, and you know Ezra. Nicola used to work for us." "Nicola Williams, one and the same," Ezra says. Jen frowns, sitting there on the steps, listening to this play out. Todd is being introduced to Nicola. But Todd has already texted Nicola, hasn't he? She runs over the dates in the phone messages. Yes, he has. He has. He texted her on the 15th saying, "Nice to chat. Today is the 16th, but he meets her on the 17th, doesn't he?" Jen shifts as quietly as possible, straining her eyes, looking past the lit green of the snooker table and beyond. On the red plush sofa attached to the far wall is Cleo, golden legs, short fringed, the lot. Jen blinks, just watching, waiting for the small talk to end. "Room for a little one," Nicola says. She grabs the cue off Todd, who sits down. It seems like a perfectly normal outing. Todd's girlfriend, her family. But Nicola's appearance has set something off, perhaps because Jen knows Todd's lying, perhaps not. There is some sinister undercurrent now, like a shark in the water. Jen shifts again to look at Todd sitting on the bench with Cleo. He isn't as close to her as he was the other night, but nevertheless he's with her. So what, does he end it tonight? Music kicks in from nowhere, big bass-led rap that drowns out their voices. Jen peers and sees that it's coming from a jukebox she hadn't noticed, a red retro-looking one with white lights surrounding the display. She sits for the duration of the song, hoping it'll stop, but another kicks in. Todd is talking to Joseph and Cleo stands and joins them too with Nicola, but Jen can't hear a thing. She can only watch it play out. Something that looks like casual conversation, but Todd is uncomfortable, she can tell. She can tell by the way he walks, toe to heel around the table, a pacing lion. Suddenly, Jen realizes the music isn't accidental. It's to drown anyone else out, any eavesdroppers like her, and others, she thinks, remembering the circling police. After an hour, Joseph puts on a coat. Todd cleans up, potting the balls effortlessly himself. As Joseph leaves with Nicola, Jen dives through the door on her left, which she discovers leads to the toilets. She stands there in a retro-decorated bathroom alone, listening for footsteps. The bathroom has vintage wallpaper up, pink clamshells, the texture gone fuzzy with age. Two wooden boxes of toiletries sit between the two sinks, also pink, and a gilded full-length mirror hangs on the wall. She leans against the sinks and thinks about what she knows. Todd meets Cleo in August. They're currently still together, but by tomorrow he's gone off her. But then, 5 days before the crime, they're back together. Yesterday, he asked Nicola for some sort of help. Today, Nicola shows up at the snooker club. He pretends not to know her. She clearly knows Cleo's uncle, used to work for him. In a few days, a blonde kid steals a car for Ezra. Cleo's family are clearly criminals. The Chanel bag. And in a few more days, Nicola is injured. and then Todd becomes a killer. She stares outside, considering this timeline of events. The window is open, letting in a steady stream of cool night air. She waits at least 10 minutes before considering leaving, then hears a low voice, laughter, outside. Without thinking, she climbs onto the unit holding the two sinks, her knees painful on the hard surface, and peers out through the crack. It's Todd. He's on the phone. He has reached his car, parked out the back. He leans his elbows on the roof. He's so tall, as he talks animatedly. She strains to hear. It's quiet out. She should be able to listen. She reaches to her side to switch the light out so she can sit here, once again unseen at yet another window. "I almost called your secret phone. I'm trying to phase Cleo out," he is saying. "Don't worry, your dirty work is safe with me." His tone is acidic, like a lemon. A pause. Jen stops breathing. "Yeah, I mean, who knows?" he adds. She has no idea who he is talking to, can't gauge it. It isn't a mate. It isn't an equal. Todd laughs again, a sort of hard laugh, bitter and sardonic. "No, that's just what I was trying to say. We're at the end of the line, aren't we?" He tilts his head back, looking up at the heavens. The moon is out, a pale hologram in the sky. The temperature is dropping. Jen is cold, kneeling there on the sinks, listening to her son, who seems to think that they're at the end of the line. What does that curiously adult expression mean? Is this why, in just under 2 weeks, he kills? He moves his gaze down like he's watching a ball slowly drop and looks straight at Jen's window. She can't look away as their eyes meet, but he moves his gaze quickly away. He can't have seen her. The glass is frosted. The light is out. "Yeah, okay," Todd says. Another pause. "Ask Nicola. See you at home," Todd says into the phone. The world seems to stop, just for a second. "See you at home. See you at home. See you at home." That can only be one person. Her husband. Day minus 13, 2040. Todd gets into his car, revs the engine and drives away, leaving Jen alone in the dark bathroom, her knees damp from the water, sitting on the side. "See you at home." The person on the end of that phone is Kelly. "Ask Nicola." Kelly knows Nicola, not Todd. Todd wasn't lying when he was introduced to her. "I almost called your secret phone." It is Kelly to whom the burner phone belongs. It is Kelly who texted Nicola. "You were just on the phone to Todd," Jen says the second she storms through the front door. Todd isn't home yet. Perhaps he caught up with Cleo again. And Jen can't wait. Who cares? She has no tomorrow. She's got to ask him now. Kelly is wearing faded jeans and a white t-shirt. He is sitting on their velvet sofa. They put it in the bay window in their living room. It fits exactly, not even a centimetre of wiggle room. They had laughed so much as they tried to thump it into place. Kelly had suggested they use lube, and Jen hadn't been able to stop giggling. She drops her handbag onto the wooden floor. The house is quiet. The lamps on low. Kelly apparently needs a moment to think. Those 3 seconds break Jen's fucking heart. "I know he's involved in something dodgy, and so do you," she says. Evidently, Kelly decides to go for an outright denial. "He's having woman trouble." Kelly's eyes don't change at all as he speaks these words, these lies. "Jen," he reaches for her. "I heard you," she says. "We talked about Cleo." "Who's Nicola?" "What? I don't know a Nicola." "Kelly," she says, the word exploding out of her. "I know you know them. Who is Joseph Jones?" "No idea," Kelly says quickly, not missing a beat. He busies himself, standing and turning on the overhead light her enigmatic husband. Mysterious or a liar? "Sorry, I don't know what you mean," he says, turning to her. As he does, she sees the glimmer of sweat around his hairline, catching the light for just a second. "I know you're lying," she says to his back as he begins to retreat again. Now he's putting shoes on, a coat. This is not up for discussion, he says. He opens the front door and leaves the house, the frame shaking as he slams it behind him.